This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick an obscure topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so that you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
The Sentry.
What is The Sentry? Well, he was a long-forgotten comic book character co-created by Stan Lee and Artie Rosen, who, for whatever reason, never quite got out of his co-creator's desk drawer and was honestly just never published. Smash cut to the 2000s, and Marvel's looking to find any way to stay out of bankruptcy. So, what do? They dusted him off and had Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee reboot the character for a modern audience. Or at least, that's what they wanted you to think. Comics was just a few years out of bankruptcy. Blah, 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 blah. It's all good. It's all good. Marvel Comics was just a few years out of bankruptcy that they had to file and that they had to file? Bankruptcy that they had to file.
Yeah.
Marvel Comics. Oh my God. All right. Fuck it. You're leading this one. Fuck it. You're leading it. I can't read.
Marvel Comics was just a few years out of the bankruptcy they had to file and the highly regrettable selling of their film rights. They were trying everything they could think of to make the company stay afloat. They gave Jimmy Palmiotti and Joe Quesada their own publishing imprint, Marvel Knights, where they were tasked with telling darker, more adventurous stories utilizing Marvel's street-level heroes. Ironically, much of this story revolves directly around Marvel and the magazine that arguably was chiefly responsible for courting the speculator boom that caused the market implosion and... Marvel's inevitable bankruptcy. That magazine? The simply titled Wizard Magazine. The first hint of anything having to do with Sentry was in Daredevil Volume 2, Number 9 from 1999. In the letters column at the end of the issue, there was a missive to the artist Artie Rosen, who was credited with working at Timely and Marvel during their formative years. It revealed that he was in poor health and that it was hoped by all the Marvel staffers that he would get well soon.
So if you don't remember, the Marvel Knights Daredevil stuff is the... David Mack, number 9, is a David Mack issue. Joe Quesada drew it. It's during the Bendis era. And this was a good time for Daredevil. It's a real good time for Daredevil.
Bri-Bri Mikey Bendis?
Bri-Bri Mikey Benz. I love...
Dresses like a 1920s gangster.
Does he? I just know him as always. He's just always wears like shorts and shit.
Maybe he was going through a phase. But whenever I first became aware of him...
Yeah.
And looked him up. He dresses like Kingpin, or at least he did.
Oh wow, like, weird. Wow, I haven't seen those photos. I'm excited to see him wearing ill fitting suits.
Yeah,
I'm assuming that means he only wears white sport coats with an ascot.
No, I mean it was more like Al Capone, I guess, than Kingpin.
I love it. It's so good. Yeah, the exact quote for the little end card in the letters page of Devil's Advocate, which is the name of the letters column for Daredevil, if you didn't know.
Which is this is giving me a weird flashback nostalgia for something that I didn't even like realize I had nostalgia for, because you know I've never been huge into comic books, or I'm more into comics now than I was when I was a kid. I did read comics.
Mm-hmm.
But I just would never have called myself a comic fan. I think I talked about it a little bit on the Stratemeyer Syndicate episode that superhero comics didn't really resonate with me as a kid. I think some of the power fantasy of it just wasn't relatable to me at the time. And also when I was a kid, I just didn't realize there was anything other than superhero comics.
Mm-hmm.
And then like later on, as I got a little older, then I started like discovering, like I used to read Buffy and some manga and the Sonic the Hedgehog comics. It was basically like whatever was in the video store that was by my house. I read Wizard.
Mm.
And so in looking at these screenshots and looking at like the letters column and stuff like that, I was like, oh yeah, like I didn't even realize that when I was a kid, I actually did this. Like, I would, I would always read the letter columns in the comics that I got. And I kind of forgot that that was like a thing that I did.
Yeah, I love letters columns, man. There's something very pure about them. And I love reading old letters columns and finding like working pros today who wrote fan letters in books from the 90s or the 80s. Or like I forget if it was an Amazing Heroes or I was reading something and there was a fan letter from the guy who started IDW Publishing, Ted Adam. And I was like, this is so weird.
Yeah.
This is so weird that he just was like, just a dude. Just reading, you know, Cerebus or whatever it was. I don't remember now. But the quote in the Daredevil at the end of the letters pages in Daredevil is, "We want to take this short bit of space to invite all of you to join us in sending off a hearty get well wish to Artie Rosen and the Rosen family. Artie, for you younger readers, was instrumental during Marvel's formative years, providing some of comics' most influential yet least acknowledged pencil and ink work. Artie, you keep inspiring us. So get well soon. Our prayers are with you, and we'll see you in the funny books." That's nice, right? I wish that they did that more to people. Like, there's so many comics creators that are just completely, like, forgotten because comics comes from a tradition of being viewed as cultural detritus. So, like, immediately after your book leaves the newsstand, you're just, like, forgotten.
Yeah.
And I wish that there was more of an effort by some of these larger publishers to kind of celebrate the history of comics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they do that every once in a while. Like when Stan passed, they put his face on all the books and that was a thing. You know, when Steve Ditko passed, they put like in remembrance of Steve Ditko stuff in all the books. But like stuff like this where it like even, I don't know, it's just weird that they don't do shit like this more.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a feedback loop of the fact that kind of nobody cares about them. Mm-hmm. So they don't feel the need to do that. And then that continues the cycle of people not caring about them.
Yeah. And unfortunately for our boy, Artie Rosen, it doesn't end too well. It ends basically just like everybody else in comics.
And then in January of 20,000.
Guy lived. He lived a while.
And then in January of 2000, Artie Rosen passed away. This announcement of his passing and the obituary was detailed in issue 103 of Wizard. The article referred to Rosen as an elder statesman, detailed a long career of many works that were uncredited, and even featured a lengthy quote from Stan Lee, who claimed that the two used to be quite close, but in recent years had lost touch.
Echoing the sentiments that you had just said about, like, you used to have, you know, you're having nostalgia for all these things you didn't realize. This, the issue 103 of Wizard has a J.G. Jones Black Widow cover on it. And I had that issue.
Yeah.
I had that issue. And I also read this article and I was like, oh, I don't know who this is. This is crazy that this guy passed away.
Yeah. I forgot that I read this. There was something on social media about Wizard that I oversaw of you talking to somebody else about it.
Mm.
And I was like, there was a weird moment where I was like, I was thinking it was Wizards of the Coast.
Oh, yeah. The trading card company.
Yeah. And then I was like, wait a minute. No, this isn't Wizards of the Coast. And I was like, why is this familiar? And then this reading this outline just opened it up. And I was like, oh, fuck. Like, I read this.
Yeah.
I discovered the Phantom through the Wizard. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. For those of you who don't know, I love the Phantom.
Yeah, and I don't even remember where I got them or why.
I mean, they were kind of like everywhere.
Like I said, I wasn't huge into comics. I just kind of read them.
I mean, in the 90s, Wizard was just ubiquitous. Like, they had it in grocery stores. They had it everywhere.
I think I must have gotten it from the video store.
Yeah.
Where I grew up in eastern New Mexico, in Roswell. in New Mexico as well as Texas and Arizona, there was a chain called Hastings, and it's a hybrid, or it was a hybrid, video store, bookstore, music store.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like Sam Goody, Blockbuster, and Barnes & Noble, like, mm-hmm. like put together. And it was like the greatest fucking store ever. And
are they still around? I feel like they were still around.
They were still around. They went out of business like a couple years ago.
Yeah.
I was on a trip with my wife and we went through Arizona and I saw one and I was like, fuck, Hastings? And we went in and I guess for a while they had pivoted to like selling a lot of like novelty collectors toys.
Mm.
They had this huge area of just like the kind of shit you'd see in a Hot Topic or a GameStop.
Mm.
Um, And I guess they had kind of stayed afloat because they had pivoted to selling these collector's toys.
Yeah.
And then they finally went out of business in like October of 2016 or something.
R.I.P. Hastings.
Yeah.
So the article has the big letters, artist Rosen passes away. And the text of the article is, the comic world lost one of its elder statesmen, Artie Rosen, the artist best remembered for his work on Crime Can't Win for Marvel Atlas and Love Experiences, died January 13, 2000 from heart failure. He was 83 years old. While the majority of his work was uncredited, Rosen's comic career spanned four decades, and his debut in Exciting Comics, number something, it doesn't say, in 1941, to his final work in Gold Key's Maude Wheels from the mid-70s. He's remembered as a staunch supporter of the industry following his retirement, and he was a fixture at comic book conventions near his home in Brooklyn, New York. And now, a quote from Stan Lee. We were close for years, and I hadn't seen him or heard from him, said Stan Lee, who worked with Rosen at Marvel. It came to me as a big shock. True believer. Some of that was added. Not all of that was a direct quote. but I remember reading this, and I remember being like, kind of before I knew the real story of Stan's real role in the comics industry, I remember being, you know, whatever, how old was I in 2013, 12, how the fuck old I was. And I remember being like, wow, it must be so crazy to be Stan Lee and like have kind of touched every corner of comics and to have all these friends. And now it must be so sad that everyone's like dying. And also, I guess it was just kind of crazy to me that Stan would give a quote for somebody. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, as an adult, it's like, of course, he's a human. But as a kid, I was like, wow, Stan's that's like getting like Walt Disney to be like, whoa, he's called me a good artist. Well, oh, man, that's crazy. Like, I totally was, like, totally bought the story hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Yeah. The next piece of information in the story comes from the immediately subsequent issue of Wizard, an article posing a question of, did Stan Lee create something before the Fantastic Four? The article alleges that Stan's initial superhero mold-breaking family might have actually been the second attempt at making a do-gooder. Wizard 104, the article reads,
Stan's secret. Did Stan Lee create something before the FF? Stan Lee may have done it again, or rather, before. The Marvel rumor mill reports the folks at the House of Ideas actually have sketches and story information for a previously unseen hero created by Lee. A source inside Marvel reports one of the sketches includes a date scribbled in ink, a mark which suggests that the character may have actually been created prior to the Fantastic Four. If it were true, and I am in no way saying it is, it would have been a tremendous impact on Marvel's history, Marvel Editor-in-Chief Bob Harris said, and on the history of comics in general. He's not kidding. Such a find would be of enormous value, both for Marvel, which would definitely benefit from the discovery of a lost Silver Age Stan Lee character, and for Lee himself. The timing would be incredibly beneficial for Lee, who's preparing to officially launch Stan Lee Media, a company that promises to offer online comics involving new heroes created by the legendary writer.
Online comics?
Online comics?
Comics you can read on the computer?
What? Stan Lee, he's just inventing so many things! I'm not at liberty to say anything about that right now, Lee said, but wouldn't it be great if there had been something before the FF? Sure, Lee worked at Marvel prior to FF's 1961 introduction, but most of his work immediately preceding FF number one was in the non-superhero genre, involving mixtures of monster stories, westerns, teenage dramas, war comics, and horror tales. All that changed, however, with the debut of The Fantastic Four, the characters ultimately credited with introducing humanity to the world of superhero comics. But were they really the first? That's a question that Lee would like answered. I'd be more than happy to look at the sketches and try and help Marvel out in any way I could, Lee offers. Like I said, I'm not sure what it is they found, but if it really looks like something I created way back when, I'd at least like to take a look at it.
Can you imagine the disparity between the expectations versus reality of like back then? Like if you were a kid back then and the idea of like, Stan Lee is creating this thing, this company where you can read new comics he created on your computer. And, you know, as a kid, to a young comics fan, like Stan Lee was like the guy who created all of the comics. So in your head, it's like, this is like the person who directly and personally made all of these cool comics that I love. And the idea of like that guy, the like Walt Disney of comics, he's going to make new comic characters and then he's going to put them out and you can read them on your computer. Like the just how amazing that sounds versus the reality of like the comic characters that like Stan Lee created on his own were just like Stripperella and just like terrible bullshit like that. Like,
yeah,
nothing his company ever put out was ever any good at all. It was all just a bunch of crap.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a much longer, more nuanced conversation coming in the near future on that topic.
Yeah. But just aside from that, just taking it at face value, like I just would like to be in the shoes of a kid back then, and maybe you were one of them who got so excited about that idea and then like the reality of it was just like the worst bullshit ever.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's real bad. I don't even remember the characters from that on Stan Lee Media Online thing. I wonder what they are. Let me look them up. Because they were, I remember them coming out and I remember it being like really hokey and like kind of limited animation things.
Yeah. Fucking motion comics.
Yeah, basically. Let's see. I don't even remember the characters. I remember a character had like a purple cape maybe. It would help if I typed Stan Lee Media and not Stan Key.
I love Stan Key.
Dude, Stan Key was the best. Company. Stan Lee Media was an internet-based creation, production, and marketing company that was founded in 1998, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy under protection in the year 2000, and ultimately dismissed from bankruptcy in 2006. In the early years, the company created Stan Lee-branded superhero franchises for applications in all media, animation, blah, 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 blah. I can't believe they only lasted like 2 years before they went under. It's so funny. This Wikipedia article doesn't have...
Because even they're just like, you don't want to fucking read about this shit.
Yeah. Some of Stan Lee Media's most important projects included the animated web series The Seventh Portal, where Stan Lee himself voiced a character, Isaias, The Drifter, which is another project, and The Accuser, which is another project. The Seventh Portal characters were licensed from interactive 3D movie attractions in 4 Paramount theme parks. Wow, I want to see that. That sounds so bad. Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know if I ever actually read any of these things or saw any of them, but I saw ads for them in, like, a bunch of Marvel comics. Oh, man. This shit was so hacky.
Yeah.
I remember being excited reading about it, and then as soon as those ads came out, I was like, this looks bad. This looks really bad. Like, even at, like, whatever, 14, 13, however old I was like, mm-mm.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I know. Just know.
And now the reveal. There is a character that Stan worked on before the Fantastic Four. Wizard 105 showcases an article that read,
Raiders of the Lost Art. Startling discovery leads Marvel to ask, was Stan Lee's Century the first Marvel hero? And the drawing is a fairly contemporary-looking sketch,
yeah,
of a dude that... is wearing a Superman-esque outfit with an S on his chest and a mask, and he has underwear on the outside of his Spandex suit and trademark Kirby Buccaneer boots.
It looks like a combination of Captain America, Captain Marvel, and Batman.
Yep, yeah. The artwork, if I had to guess, I would say that artwork was done by... I don't know. I would have to say it's either, like, the face looks kind of like poor man's John Byrne. So that makes me think it might be somebody like Bob McLeod or what's that guy's name?
I think David Byrne drew it.
David Byrne. Yes, it's definitely David Byrne. And every time he draws,
I drew the Sentry. I drew the Sentry. Look at my line work.
My quest had ching.
3-point perspective.
Look at those Buccaneer boots.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah. And yeah, instead of the Talking Heads, he starts a comic book cover band called the Talking Double Spreads.
Yes.
Come on, that pun was great. So the article reads... Next
we're going to do some craft work comedy.
Yeah, yeah, no shit, right? Yeah, or some Bauhaus comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Artie Rosen is dead. Artie Rosen is dead.
So the actual article reads, Marvel struck gold, or silver, as it were. The folks at Marvel have uncovered both descriptions and character sheets for a Silver Age character called the Sentry, created by Stan Lee and Artie Rosen in 1961. Oh, and there's a big, like, bursting balloon that says, Wizard Explosive! Which is kind of a funny dichotomy during this time period, because comics journalism was basically just Wizard and the Comics Journal, and the Comics Journal would never have covered something as kind of hokey as this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool that they found this character, but also it's not like they found, like, full unpublished stories or something. Like, there's an urban legend that, like, Steve Ditko, after he left Marvel, made a bunch of Doctor Strange stories and just never published them, and they just are locked in a vault somewhere. That is cool.
Yeah.
Finding some character sketches, I mean, it's fun, I guess, but it's nothing more than just kind of like, oh, yeah, there's a character sketch. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, imagine all the countless just unused ideas from artists that just exist somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Topps Comics tried to found that whole imprint off of Kirby's waste bin ideas, the Satan City saga. Like, none of those characters are real characters. They're all just like a character sketch and a name.
I mean, there's a cachet of unpublished Bob comics somewhere in my parents' garage.
Is this your childhood character, Bob?
Yeah.
Tell me everything about Bob.
It's really even not even that interesting. It was like I drew a comic specifically to make this kid laugh on the bus on the way home. And so, like, every comic was just like this character Bob just getting, like, killed in some like really, like, complicated and elaborate way. And I just would, like, at some point throughout the day, I'd just be like, I would try to think of the funniest thing to make this kid laugh on the bus. And I just have, there's just, like, probably literally hundreds of those.
I love it. I wish you would publish them.
And, you know, Wizard isn't fucking covering that shit.
No, that's because Wizard ain't around no more. Spoiler alert. Rumors have been swirling about the existence of the pre-Fantastic Four Marvel hero for months. While Lee's attachment to the project has always been suspect, Rosen's involvement is something of a surprise. Rosen, an artist whose comic career spanned four decades, may have been best remembered for his art on Crime Can't Win for Marvel Atlas Comics. He passed away in January. In fact, Rosen's passing actually paved the way for the discovery of the Sentry. Blanche Rosen, Artie's widow, found the file containing the Sentry's information while organizing her husband's effects. Blanche mentioned she found a box labeled Marvel Comics in the den, said Lee after contacting the widow after his friend's death. So she sent it back to the Marvel offices. That's where Paul Jenkins came in. The Hulk writer unknowingly took a folder from an Iron Man scribe Joe Quesada's office. I was rooting around for some stuff to read during my trip home, and Joe told me to grab something from the submissions pile, Jenkins said. Honestly, I didn't even notice the Sentry stuff. And when Jenkins finally got around to looking at the fateful folder, he discovered it contained sketches and a copy of Startling Stories Number 1, which was reportedly contained the Sentry's first appearance. At the time, the writer said he basically ignored the incredible contents. I just thought it was an old comic, Jenkins said. I thought it was one of those crazy old comics characters. And then underneath that, there's a photo of current day year 2000 Stan Lee and an old ass photo of Artie Rosen in a Navy.
Old Artie Rosie.
Old Artie Roro in a, Navy
yeah.
uniform?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because apparently there were no photos of Artie Rosen at the time of his death. Or at any other point in his life other than when he enlisted in.
I mean, there might have been photos of him at the time of his death. I doubt they wanted to use that for the magazine.
Bro, how great would that be?
Just an
open casket photo of Artie Rosen.
Dead body next to Stan Lee.
That'd be kind of great.
Just for all these kids.
The story goes on, and we don't have to read the whole thing, but it basically details how, you know, the article details how Jay Lee and our boy Jenkins are going to reboot this character for a modern audience. And they're going to kind of have sequences in it that are kind of drawn in a Kirby style as a throwback to the character's origin, you know, being in the 1950s and 60s. And then obviously Jay Lee is going to come in and do the, he's going to be drawing the series, and this is kind of their sequel, their spiritual sequel to the Inhumans miniseries that they did in like 1999, which won the Eisner. And like, they, you know, at this point in Marvel's kind of trajectory, they're all just like, oh God, we need any way to make money, please, just anything. And the fact that Jenkins and Lee did a very critically acclaimed and commercially selling book utilizing, at this point, ostensibly forgotten Jack Kirby characters, it was kind of, you got carte blanche to do whatever you wanted. So the series comes out. Cover, we're looking at the cover right now. It's very nice looking. Jay Lee, The Century. It's a 5-issue miniseries.
Yes, that use of negative space.
Yeah, really, really cool. The artwork is great. It was a 5-issue miniseries, and it kind of got so much hype based off of the kind of surrounding excitement off of these couple Wizard articles that they actually expanded it past just that 5-issue miniseries. And they did, I think, 5 or 6 one-shots where the Century would kind of like pop up at different points in Marvel history and interact with characters.
The revival miniseries was released to positive reviews, but the most interesting part of the miniseries was that every issue featured a behind-the-scenes interview with Stan detailing the creation of the Century.
I pulled one of these interviews just because I wanted to read a specific quote from it, because I feel like this is very, it's a very quintessential Stan Lee. Like I said, most of my memories of the character are kind of vague. I figure that I had probably intended him to be a great hero, but that also means that I intended him to be a great human. That's part of the Marvel way. We've always done things here. The heroes are just like you and me, with as many pimples and flaws as we have. And sometimes, no matter how strong or powerful they are, they have feet of clay, with fear in their brightly colored little booties. So I just want to point out that all of this is basically just hyperbole of him being like, I don't remember anything about this, but this is the like public persona that I've cultivated over the past 50 years or so. And he kind of like lines up the creation of the Century with the way that he normally talks about this process, where he kind of is... He's usually just like overly gregarious. He's overly kind of like this weird, like fatherly flattering to the artists usually, where he'll just be like, Jack was great. We always got along and he made all the ideas better. Jack was great. But what I wanted for the book was for it to be this cosmic wonder. I wanted us to go to places we'd never seen before. I wanted us to come face to face with gods. Which is like, we all know that the god fascination comes directly from Kirby. Like, look at all the rest of his work.
Yeah.
The fucking Eternals. Fucking the new gods. Like, he's obsessed, you know, fucking...
Spacey, Spacey, Fly, Fly.
Yeah. And it's just fascinating.
Which is also the name of Kevin Spacey's new autobiography.
Yeah, they had to change it from Kevin Spacey, Bye Bye, to Spacey, Spacey, Fly, Fly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing I find interesting about this is we talked about this in the Stratemeyer Syndicate episode. If you haven't listened to that, go back and listen to episode 1. It's one of my favorites. We went episode 1 and then it was all
downhill. Yeah. That episode 1, great. Emotionally raw. Educational. It was great. Everything else we've done, phoning it in.
Yeah. But we talked about these creators, particularly creators... with a highly iterative process, and how whether or not they were, you know, as fully involved in the creation of things as they claim to be, you know, whatever the realities of that are, there was clear patterns of this one person sort of being obsessed or fixated on this one type of story. And I found it interesting that, you know, even in this, he talks about this thing that he talks about a lot, which is this idea of like, you know, Stanley's one thing is that like he creates like heroes that have like a flaw, and it's like so almost simplistic in its conception of just like, and it goes back to that sort of assembly line iterative process of just like, you know, the Marvel way is to have a character who's a hero, he's a god, or he has some kind of superpower, he rides in a robot. But he's a pedophile. Like, it's just like, it's like,
oh
it just has to, you just like, it's,
oh my God.
But you could just plug in anything like that. And like, I find it interesting that like, even in this, he's talking about that.
Yeah. Cause like the Sentry's weakness is he basically has an alternate persona. Like it's supposed to be a metaphor for mental illness. It's supposed to be a metaphor for either depression or bipolar or what have you. But in comics, because everything's dialed up to 11 in superhero corporate controlled stuff, it's a literal other entity that is lurking within him that is a kind of shadow self called Void. And the actual miniseries itself is fine. It's not as good as the Inhumans miniseries. That Inhumans miniseries, I think, holds up so well. But I think it's just kind of in some ways a little miscast because this whole thing is kind of this what if Superman ... riff. But the issue being that Jay Lee is not a person who can do bright, uplifting, bouncy, inviting artwork in that way. Like everything he does is garbed in shadow. It's, you know, chiaroscuro is how he pays his bills, man. Like it's all just the human body just covered in black. And in a story where Superman has to, in air quotes, Superman has to confront that, you want there to be a visual juxtaposition, right? You want there to be the brightness and the joy of being a superhero and then the darkness. But this miniseries is kind of just stock and trade. What if everything looked like it was rusted and cracked and broken all the time? Because that's kind of just his visual aesthetic.
Another thing about this miniseries is like, I'm sure at the time it was really interesting, but now in a current climate, this just sounds so kind of like hack to me. Not hack, but it just sounds so like
Yeah.
Because it's like everything is like this now. Like every story is like postmodern. Yep. Like what if it was the thing, but it was about the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love weird metatextual stuff, and we're about to get to a big turning point in the story, but I think that the story surrounding this story is way more interesting than the actual thing.
Yeah. And now we come to the reveal, the part in every episode of Scooby-Doo where they pull the mask off the would-be ghost, except 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, where the ghosts are real, available on Amazon Prime. Wizard Magazine reveals that the whole story is a hoax.
Oh,
oh shit.
Shit! Oh shit!
We've been hoaxing you!
Oh, hoaxed!
We got hoaxed!
Oh,
and
no,
now we're hoaxing!
Oh, so much hoax!
We got hoaxed.
And
then we hoaxed. I got hoaxed.
You got hoaxed.
You got hoaxed got hoaxed when you were a kid.
Yes.
I got hoaxed reading this.
Yeah.
And then now we're passing the value on to the customer.
6 degrees of hoaxination.
Pay it. Hoax it forward.
Hoax it forward.
Starring Haley Joel Osment.
Starring Haley Hoax.
Helen Hunt.
Hoaxley Joel Osment.
Hoaxley Joel Osment and Hoax and Hunt.
And Kevin Hoaxley, supposedly, I got nothing.
But it was a hoax.
It's not real. None of this.
None of this was real.
None of it. 0%. Which is probably not that surprising, considering that our podcast.
Stan Lee was never a real person.
Yeah, yeah. It's. I mean, I like I said, the idea that they would make up a fake character and pass it off as real, and that it worked and people bought it. That's awesome. Like, I wish there was more of that. That's really cool. The actual logistics of the book and the quality of the artistic content within, for me personally, kind of fall short of the high level that this set.
Reminds me a little bit of our old friend Tommy Hanhans and the Zodiac Killer movie.
Yeah, it is kind of, yeah. Apparently that's just a trait now with all these episodes. Like, I feel like our show is basically just like, remember that time where there was some stuff that wasn't really there? Or that they told you there, but wasn't really there, but then you thought it was there, but then it wasn't there?
Deep cuts.
Deep cuts.
Executive produced by David Blaine.
Yeah, pretty much. Bro, I'm just saying. D. Blaine, holler at your boys.
You want to produce this podcast?
You know where to find us, D. Blaine's.
You better know or else I'll stop believing in you.
Yeah, I agree.
If you can't find us right now, then what kind of fucking illusionists are you?
What's that behind your ear, Andrew? Oh my God, it's David Blaine!
I pulled David Blaine out of my ear. Hello.
So basically, in the next issue of Wizard, they reveal that it's all been a hoax and it's been a publicity stunt, and that Artie Rosen wasn't actually a real person.
Wait a minute. Artie Rosen isn't real? This didn't occur to me when I read it myself, but as we were reading through this about 10 minutes ago,
yeah.
I had a thought which brought me a tremendous amount of joy, and I didn't want to say it then because obviously we hadn't revealed the twist,
mm-hmm.
but it occurred to me that definitely during this hoax, before it was revealed, there were several people who acted like they knew who Artie Rosen was.
Totally.
And talked to their friends and acted pretentious about knowing about this comic that he did and and having like this. And then just when this got revealed, just never talking about it again.
Yep.
And just that silent like acknowledgement of like, we know what happened. We know what was said. You're not going to bring it up and I'm never going to bring it up. And we're just going to never talk about that ever again.
Yep.
That day, a couple of days ago, when I acted all condescending towards you.
Oh, my God. You don't know who Artie Rosen was? Come on.
And that definitely happened.
100%. In fact, I probably was friends with some people that did.
And
that.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I can't believe that. I'm just kind of surprised. Like, I don't know if you can do this now. You know? Like, I don't know. Just because of the way the internet works, I don't know that this can happen again. And that's kind of sad. Like, I love this big, overly elaborate theatrical production surrounding a book.
Well, you know, there was a thing. This wasn't a purposeful thing, but something kind of like this happened. Well, number one, you're right in that, like, you know, I work in the internet.
You work inside the internet?
Yeah, you know, I said a couple episodes ago, you can find me in the place where the lawnmower man is.
You did say that, yeah.
I'm in the front lines of this, and you know, and we've talked about this on a couple episodes as well. It's all interconnected, but you know, we're living in a post-truth society where, you know, don't trust anything you ever read. And even when you do, it doesn't matter. So, you know, coming up with like this thing, like it would be really hard to sell this because there are so many rumors and lies and things like that floating around already that like this would just get lost in a sea of other hoaxes that are currently going on. But I will say a couple months ago, there was a story that maybe you're familiar with the name. I'm forgetting the name, but there was an actress who was a sort of a cult horror movie actress, and she had also served as a model for a bunch of artwork in like the in Heavy Metal magazine.
Julie Strain.
Yeah, and she it was announced that she died.
Yeah.
And then like 4 days later, they were like, oh no, she wasn't dead. And like some production company had like just said on their social media that she died. And like nobody knows why they did it.
Really? I thought has Julie Strain since passed away? Or is this?
No. Let's see.
Because the story that I'm familiar with, and I didn't know that second part that it was like all a hoax. But the story that I was aware of, which may or may not be true now, was that Julie Strain got kicked in the head by a horse as a child.
She did. That happened, and she's dealing with a degenerative form of dementia.
Yeah.
But she's not dead.
Oh, really?
I just looked it up and she's still alive. So it was announced that she was dead. And then like 4 days later, her family was like, she's alive. And this production company had announced this. And it was like the whole story originated from them posting about it on Twitter and just basically being like, our hearts go out to the family of Julie Strain. And, they didn't really explain why. They apologized for it, but they didn't explain like
maybe that was why, like they were trying to like sell a movie off the back of her passing away.
Well, exactly, which is what I was getting to, is like this wasn't the same thing because it wasn't like a purposeful publicity stunt, but this did make waves and it got people talking about Julie Strain that probably otherwise would have never known she existed.
Yeah.
And it became this news story, and this production company that said this, they got lifted up and talked about in the news to the point where people who didn't know who wouldn't normally know about this production company were talking about this production company. So, you know, in another world, this could have been a thing where Julie Strain, well, I guess she wouldn't because she actually genuinely does have this dementia. But, you know, another actor could be working on a movie with some production company, stage this whole hoax that they die. It would be super weird and creepy, but they stage a hoax that they die. It gets announced. Everyone's freaking out. And then they go, they turn back and like, no, I'm not dead. And then, but I do have a movie coming out, you know, like they could have done something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They were given the amount of publicity that would have allowed for something like that to happen. So, you know, this wasn't a publicity stunt, but I feel like the conditions of this seem like indicative that like something like this could maybe happen.
Mm. You heard it here first. Dave Baker is dead. His new book, Fuck Off Squad 2, Fucking Off Harder, comes out this fall. Please continue purchasing a copy wherever books are sold.
He's also dead, as we said.
He's definitely dead. And if you don't buy a book right now,
he'll die again.
He'll die again.
Do you want to be responsible for double death?
I'm Casey Gasham. Today on the Top 40 Hits, we're talking about Dave Baker's death.
No, I don't want to.
But basically, the Wizard puts out an article called The Big Lie. The headline is, Marvel fooled millions by passing off The Sentry as a forgotten Stan Lee classic and got a smash hit. Now, the truth can be told. Which is just like, it's such a Stockholm Syndrome-y, baby, I promise I've changed situation. Where like Marvel, granted their business practices were awful, but most of the speculator boom, most of the buying 15 issues of Adjectiveless X-Men number one, that stuff, that culture was nurtured at Wizard. And specifically Garib Sheamus. Like Garib Sheamus and Steve Sheamus were, at this point in time, criminal adjacent. We'll get into them later and how they became full criminals. But at this point, they were criminal adjacent, where they were purposefully stoking a business model that everybody knew couldn't last, specifically so that they could make a shitload of money. Like they made deals with Valiant where Valiant would pay them money to put the new Valiant number one on their top 10 most valuable back issue, or, you know, a new number ones that are coming out, specifically so that they would have speculator spikes in sales. And there was a formula where the Valiant guys basically were like, if we pay whatever the number is, I'm making this up, $20,000 to Wizard to get 2 months of, oh, it's the number one hottest back issue on sale, we will sell 200,000 issues and we will net a profit of X. And like Garib Sheamus,
forced artificial scarcity.
Yeah, completely.
Farts.
Garib Sheamus farts.
Yeah, I mean, that's that I was going to say, you know, and it's kind of similar to that. I just what's amusing to me about this is just how the whole thing is just manufactured. Like there's this article like The Big Lie, Marvel. It's like, but you made this whole thing up. Like this isn't like a story that you've gotten a scoop on. Like you conspired with them to make up this entire thing.
Yeah. Without you, there is no lie.
Yeah.
Like, you're the one telling the lie. Marvel was just like, wouldn't it be weird if we did this thing? Yeah, it's ridiculous. And so there's this big, you know, 4-page article all about how they came up with the idea. Oh, also, I was wrong. It wasn't poor man John Byrne. It was John Romita Sr. that did the original kind of like Artie Rosen drawing of the Sentry. And the photo that was run 2 issues prior of Artie Rosen was actually the great, like, grand uncle or something of somebody, like a Wizard staffer.
It was exactly what you talked about in the Stratemeyer Syndicate episode about the picture that was used.
Oh, yeah, like, who the fuck is this guy? Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's an interesting quote in one of the paragraphs for this from Paul Jenkins, where he says, the promotion was a reflection of the story, and that made it all the more valid to me. Which was, it's interesting because I don't necessarily disagree, but I also don't know that like I previously said, the story really lives up to this big hoax, you know? Like, it's such an outlandish idea, and it's such a, like, there were all these cogs within, you know, plans and plans and plans. And the story itself is just kind of like, what if Superman was bad? That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, taking the story at face value, the thing, you know, I didn't want to talk about this earlier because we were concealing the twist. But, you know, if this was real, it almost kind of seems not that interesting to me. Like, because number one, the character is just kind of generic. Like, it's not particularly interesting. It's not like you uncovered this really awesome thing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we uncovered this like kind of just uninteresting sketch
yeah.
that somebody drew and yeah. just didn't do anything with.
Yeah.
And it was technically drawn before the Fantastic Four, so
it's this kind of weird, like, you're putting, because you know how there's like just you just have like a billion shitty ideas before you finally get to the good idea. It's this false equivalency for people who aren't creative of like, well, look at this idea that he discarded on the way to the good idea. That means that this idea is good too.
Yeah, every idea has like equal value.
Yeah, yeah, like it,
and because they don't realize that like. People who make stuff, like they have like 1,000 ideas that they just lose interest in, immediately think sucks, or just kind of doesn't work out for some reason. And yeah. It's just like that, you know, ideas are important, but an idea like that, like people have thousands of them and they really have zero inherent value until they become a real thing. Like an idea is meaningless until it becomes a real thing.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting in this article is that it lays out kind of who did what, right? So Stan basically had nothing to do with this whole process. They just kind of like put his name on it. And surprisingly, he took part in the process to promote his company. Shocker.
Yeah. The thing that I think is funny about that is like even in this whole promotional marketing thing/hoax. Even in this, it's so funny to me that like the concept of this hoax is falsely attributing the creation of a character to Stan Lee.
I know.
it's like you can't make this shit up.
It's you can't win, man. It just sucks so hard. The other part that's interesting to me about this is that Rick Veitch, the Swamp Thing artist, it plays an important role in this, which is just hinted at here. There's a little inset box that's like outlining what everyone did. And the Rick Veitch portion says, Rick Veitch, artist Veitch, contributed a lot of ideas to the Sentry, like Reed Richards and the Sentry being best friends. And Nick's idea was that the Watcher would remember who the Sentry was and play a role in the story. And Artie Rosen was originally going to be named Chick Rivette, an anagram for Rick Veitch, which seems like a fairly innocuous little thing, you know, of just like, oh, maybe he was in the room. Maybe, you know, he and Paul Jenkins are friends. Like Rick Veitch published a lot of stuff at Tundra, which was Kevin Eastman's publishing company that Paul Jenkins worked at for a long time. Like maybe they just were, you know, he was just kind of a guy around and they were like giving him credit. You know, that's cool. But the actual truth of that is a little bit darker, and one that I sort of understand, and one that is kind of really fucking sad. And on that, ad break. Act 2, the true origin of the Sentry. So, contrary to that small little one-off, oh, look, Rick Veitch was a guy in Wizard magazine. This is a direct quote from Rick Veitch's blog, which if you haven't read, I highly recommend just in general, whether you like Rick Veitch's artwork or not. He has written a bunch of stuff about comics history and a bunch of stuff about old convention life and a bunch of stuff about the like 70s and 80s publishing industry that is fascinating. So if you're into comics history, go read Rick Veitch's blog, which is, I believe, just rickveitch.com. Paul Jenkins and I were old buds, having met while at Mirage Studios. We worked closely together on Brat Pack and Max Immortal at Tundra. Paul was focused mainly on production and editing back in those days, but clearly had a potential as a writer. He and I had often discussed a story we wanted to develop concerning an over-the-hill guy struggling with addiction who had a tight relationship with his dog. Paul was trying to come up with a way to show the character's addiction problem as manifestation in his unconsciousness. At one point, if I remember correctly, Paul pitched a horror version of this plot to Steve Bissett for Taboo, although nothing came of it. In the late 1990s, Paul and I came together to try and develop it into a superhero pitch for Marvel. At the time, Paul and I came together to work up the Sentry concept for Marvel Comics, as it was a financial mess. Sales were lousy, with the exception of the Marvel Knights line, a side imprint produced outside of Marvel offices by Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti. Paul had a good connection with Quesada, and the plan was to create a brand new character that we would pitch to Joe and Jimmy for the Marvel Knights line. Paul saw the character as a guardian type, with a watchtower. We tossed around some possible names, and initially hit on the Centurion, which seemed a bit clunky. It was Paul who boiled down Centurion to Sentry, which sounded so good we couldn't believe it wasn't already taken. What I brought to the table was the retro angle. I'd been involved with two major retro projects, 1963 and Supreme, in which Alan Moore and I had developed a sort of deadpan approach to the genre. Then and now, most retro stories you see tend to be over-exaggerated. The dumbness is caricatured, played for laughs in both the writing and the art. Alan and I believed in such an approach was to be avoided. It was this close-as-you-can-get-to-mimicry approach that I wanted to bring to the century, creating a false history for the character with versions going back to Timely in the 1940s. Paul liked the idea, but wondered how we could explain the character's absence from 60 years of company continuity. That's when the light bulb went on. I'm quite sure it was my suggestion that something so horrible happened to the Sentry that all memory of the event and the Sentry himself had to be wiped out, probably by some Marvel character on the scale of the Watcher. Right there, Paul and I knew we had it. The Sentry's quest to return his memories and powers, a solution for his absence from Marvel continuity, and a motivation for his attack on his own unconscious. We quickly ran it through some of the other Marvel characters, plotting out how they figured into the mass amnesia. Most of them would have their memories erased, but some, like the Hulk, wouldn't, and a few, like Reed Richards and Doctor Doom, would be smart enough to figure out what happened. As Paul and I gleefully riffed on how we would depict the Sentry through the various decades, we realized that we couldn't use the names of any other real artists or writers. The crux of our scheme was that the characters had been around for 60 years, but it wouldn't be fair to say that he had been written by Stan Lee and drawn by Jack Kirby, John Romita, Neil Adams, Jim Starlin, Frank Miller, or Rob Liefeld, so we decided to create our own nom de plumes. I'd been playing around with an anagram program on my computer and came up with the variation of my own name that I liked, Chick Rivette. Paul quickly anagrammed his own name and decided on Juan Pinkles, which is pretty great. Juan Pinkles is, that's solid. The addition of our literary doubles implied how the Sentry had not only been forgotten from Marvel continuity, but by the real world as well. Paul wrote an outline and I did a concept art that you can see here. There's a photo of a character with a kind of like square face guard holding a what are those things called? Pike, stick, spear. Paul wrote an outline and I did the concept art as well. And we were both excited. Paul was going to get to do his What If Superman Was Real bit. And I was going to get to play with Marvel's sandbox of characters and art styles that had heavily influenced me growing up. We knew our idea asked a lot of Marvel continuity, but the company was on the skids, and that is often the best time to pitch something revolutionary. The Marvel Knights line was proof of that. Paul set up a meeting with Quesada and took the train down to the city. I waited for Paul's call, letting me know if it was a go or a dud. Now, anyone who knows Paul Jenkins knows that he can be direct and to the point. And when he called me to let me know that the Sentry meeting had gone, how the Sentry meeting had gone with Joe Quesada, he immediately told me he was going to do the book with Jay Lee. This set me back on my heels for a bit. I mean, you hear the concept and the storyline for existing characters being hijacked by a publisher and editors all the time, but not so for a completely original concept. Thing is, bringing in Jay Lee made a lot of sense. He and Paul had done a corker of a job on Inhumans, which had even won an Eisner. I couldn't fault a publisher starved for hits with maximizing box office potential, even if it meant me being thrown under the bus. I had plenty of other projects to keep me going, and more importantly, Paul had been there for me more than once for Tundra, so I didn't make a stink.
At least I have Swamp Thing.
At least I have Swamp Thing. But when Paul enthusiastically went about the marketing plan and built around Chick Rivette, I had to gently remind him that really he couldn't use an anagram of my name as it really would stick out. But basically, like, I feel bad because this whole thing was Rick Veitch's idea.
It sounds like he had all of the ideas that made this cool and interesting.
Yeah.
And the way he described, I mean, the way he you're saying that you, like, the miniseries is like okay.
Yeah.
The way he describes it sounds awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let me be frank and say that I have not read it in a long time. And when I read it originally, I was like, no, this is fine.
Let me be Steve and say I've never read it.
Let me be George and say, you know what? It's okay.
Let me be Arthur and say that I wrote it.
Wouldn't that be let me be Stan?
Oh, fuck.
Let me be Jack and say that it was actually me who wrote it.
Let me be Juan Pinkles.
Let me be Juan Pinkles.
Just let me be him.
Yeah.
Let me just live in that skin.
Dude, I feel like you could probably get the rights to Juan Pinkles from Paul Jenkins and he wouldn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I legally change my name to Juan Pinkles? Do you give me your blessing?
I mean, I've already changed my name to Chick Rivette, so.
It's really easy to change your name now. You just did it on your computer as we were talking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting that that even in this weird metatextual story, it kind of mimics actual comics history, where there's always a person who kind of did all the work who gets shoved out of the way.
Yeah.
With Batman, Bob Kane didn't really do anything, and Bill Finger and Jerry Robinson did everything, and they don't get any credit. Like, even legally, like, they're not even on the books. I think Bill Finger is now, but that's like 3 years of the 80 years that the character's been around. With fucking Stan and Jack, like, Jack Kirby did 95% of the work on those books and doesn't receive the appropriate level of credit, right? And
what was the reason why they shut him out? Because, I mean, at this time, it wasn't like he was some, like, small up, like, he was no slouch in terms of clout. Was it just because they wanted to package them as, like, from the team that did this really successful Inhumans book?
Yeah, it's 100% that. And also, like, I like Rick Veitch a lot, but he's just not Jay Lee. Like, Jay Lee, even now, 20 years later, is still one of the biggest artists in the comics industry. Like, a book that Jay Lee draws is going to sell hundreds of thousands, if not millions of copies more at a little bit before then, you know, no book sells millions of copies now. But, like, Jay Lee is still one of the biggest artists in...
I sold a million copies of Bob.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
To the one guy on the bus?
Yeah, he bought a million copies.
He got a million copies. He was a speculator?
Yeah.
Either just like lying in his bedroom.
I was like, these are going to be worth a lot of money someday.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me, though, that even in this like weird pantomime of comics history, this kind of chaos magic incantation, this like primordial rite of creativity, it still happens. Like, there's still a guy that just gets fucked.
Yeah.
Which is, like, so goddamn depressing. Like, Stan Lee didn't even have anything to do with this, and he still took credit for fucking Rick Veitch's idea. Like, even in the world where Stan literally has nothing to do with it, which is a lot of Stan Lee things. Like, it's just so...
we skipped over it, or we just didn't read it, but there was in the interview where he's talking about the hoax... They interviewed Stanley about the hoax after it was revealed, and he literally said, I was into it. Like, anybody who knows me knows that I'll never pass up a chance to take credit for something.
Yeah, yeah. Which he's like joking. He's like, you know, doing his sideshow huckster. Aw shucks. You know, I'm not really that guy. I'm not really a snake oil salesman. But also, I'm gonna just literally say to you that. If credit isn't nailed down, I'll just steal it. Like, it's so crazy. I don't know. It part of me wonders if this project had come out like a few years earlier, like if it had come out instead of coming out at the like bottom of the trough of like the speculator bubble bursting, if it had come out in like instead of 2000 and if it had come out in like 1993, if this book would have been just the greatest, you know, if it would be up there with Watchmen, and not even because of the quality of the work, which is objectively not bad. It just doesn't really do it for me in the way that Inhumans did, but just because of the surrounding story. Because I can't even really think of many times in comics history that a book has had a concerted conspiracy around it, you know? Like, it's so crazy that they got away with it, and then we're like, look what we did.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's two things. Number one, it's crazy now. It's crazy looking back on it that, like, this thing that was just talked about in a magazine, like, actually served as a successful marketing campaign for a product. Like, can you, like, if this happened now, like this in a magazine, nobody would even know about it.
Yeah.
It was just, and even people who do read the magazine, like, they would just... not take it seriously. Like, the cultural cachet of stuff that is talked about in magazines is so invaluable now that it's just crazy looking back on this and being like, oh, like, magazines, especially in a industry where, like, this was pretty much the magazine. Like, it's just crazy to look back on it and see how powerful, like, it was able to be at a time. And then, you know, second, it's just I feel like it wasn't done. It could have been done a lot cooler, but it is just really, it's a really cool way to, I can't believe everybody agreed to do this.
Yeah.
I guess the reason why they agreed to do it is because of the marketing aspect of it, that they thought that it would.
And there was nothing left to lose.
But otherwise, you know, it's surprising that all these people would have just agreed to, like, do this weird little hoax idea.
Yeah. It's like a weird performance art comics project.
Yeah.
It's so fun. I love And I also love the fact that, like, the emphasis wasn't on Jay Lee and Paul Jenkins. You know what I mean? Because I feel like the gut instinct for a creator in that situation is to make the hoax in some way about them so that they are the center of the story. Mm-hmm. But A, incorporating Stan is really funny. And B, because I think if you... There is a version of this conspiracy that, like, when it comes out that it's fake, kind of is metatextual commentary on the fact that Stan steals credit for things.
Yeah, it's very strange how that
it could be that way. That. Yeah, but it doesn't quite land. You know what I mean? Like, it is, but it also isn't. Like, it could have very easily been shifted to really be like. With a couple interviews here and there or a couple little pieces by, you know, like if there had been a second part of the hoax where Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee went missing because they didn't get any credit or something. You know what I mean? Like there's a whatever the end of it is would have been a commentary on Stan's role in it. And that obviously didn't happen. But it would be really it would be fascinating if it did.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is Paul Jenkins, I don't know what you're doing on these days, but you should do The Centurion and have the same hoax with Stan Lee again and do that.
But it would all take place on comicbook.com.
Ugh, home of listicle clickbaity bullshit.
I wonder if there's any century truthers out there who are just
Artie Rosen is real. Yeah. I met Artie Rosen at a convention in Pacoima.
No, the guy that I was talking about earlier who said that, he just, in order to save face, he just had to double, whenever the thing came out, he just had to double down and be like, no, he's real.
Artie Rosen, I went to school with Artie Rosen. You think I don't know Artie Rosen? I want to meet this person. I feel like this person's name is like Eugene.
The idea is so funny to me that there was a neckbeard douche who just like claimed that they knew this person and acted condescending
and
about
it
to their
friends. And he's been doing it for 20
years.
And
then whenever it was revealed, he just had to just double down on it in order to not humiliate himself. And he's just crafted his entire life around believing that Artie Rosen is real and that Stanley and Artie Rosen really created this character.
I love it.
And his friend, like, they're just old, and he's like, just admit it.
Just what? Admit what? I don't have anything to admit.
Just admit that you pretended like you knew who this guy was, and then it was embarrassing. Yeah, it was embarrassing. Sure, fine. Just stop with this. Stop with the facade.
We're like 80 years old. We're going to die. You didn't know Artie Rosen. Yes, I did. I don't know what to tell you. We went to a PS-108 together.
You didn't live in New York.
I love it so much. I just, oh God, it's so depressing to me. Everything involving the like wizard connection and them just exploiting everything is.
Someday they'll find it. The wizard connection. The lovers, the dreamers, and me.
The Garib, the Seamus, and me. Yeah, it's funny. All of my notes for the like last discussion bit are kind of what we've been talking about this whole time.
Yeah, they've been
peppered throughout. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm fascinated by the story. And I'm also fascinated by how nobody remembers this specifically because of Brian Bendis, because Bendis put the Century on the new Avengers team and kind of took the character and made him, you know, a character in the Marvel Universe, not in Marvel Knights, like just a straight. Right down the middle, like he is Superman. He has this mental health thing. He's the big heavy on the team. And now he's going to be in all these Avengers comics. And I don't even know if most people who know the Century even remember that this miniseries happened, let alone this miniseries had a hoax behind it. Like, I think they're just like, oh, God, another Century fucking cameo in this stupid Bendis run. Like, we don't like the Century. Please stop writing the Century. Like, there was a period of time where Bendis was like, he was obsessed with taking lower rung characters and like making them cool, you know? And he did so really well with some of them. Like, we wouldn't be talking about Luke Cage today if Bendis hadn't made Luke Cage like a B-list character, if not low A-list character in the Avengers pantheon.
And
Choochie Boochie
is DC.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, he loves Choochie Boochie. Yeah. He also loves Fingal Snap Gornenbort, which was a little-known character from the romance era that got brought into the Marvel Comics around the time that Steve Ditko left Spider-Man. So there's a big cameo from him towards the end of Steve Ditko's Spider-Man run. So if you haven't...
Say that character's name again.
What do you mean?
Say it. No, say it again.
What do you mean?
What's the character's name?
What are you talking about? The character that I just said?
Yes.
I know his name. I don't need to say it again.
It's like, I know he doesn't remember what the name was.
I know the character's name. I know the character's name. The character's name was Gringle Strat Swirkenfort.
I don't even think you picked up on that. I don't think you remember that was the name of the fake Tintin character.
Oh, yeah. I totally did not. Since we record these late at night, my memory is just like done. Like after I leave this recording studio, I'm like, I think we recorded one. I don't know. Choochie Woochies? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was Choochie Woochie.
Choochie Woochie. That's a solid name. Yeah. I feel like we should make a comic. Or you know what? We should sell t-shirts like how Pete Holmes does. It's like a little Tintin head, but it says Choochie Woochie at the bottom.
Yes.
And the word balloon that Tintin is saying is just like, Hergé was a Nazi.
And then just go around like similar to that fictional Artie Rosen truther, just act super condescending to people about how
you don't know Choochie Woochie.
And then somehow that like resonates out. And then like 5 years from now, we just see like a teenager wearing a Choochie Woochie shirt.
Somebody cosplays as Choochie Woochie. Yeah. They're walking by my table at San Diego and I'm like, oh my God, Choochie Woochie. Yeah, duh.
I
love it too.
I want to go to there.
Me too. Oh boy. Closing thoughts.
This story weirdly reminded me of a part of my nostalgic childhood that I forgot existed. Mm. I largely think of my childhood as a lot of watching movies, watching TV, renting movies from the video store, watching movies on HBO, and reading books. And I kind of forgot this weird little missing chunk of like reading these like magazines, whether it was like Wizard or Game Informer for video games.
Was the trading card one Scry? Did you ever read Scry?
I never read that. I did read some other like trading card game magazine.
Did you read Toy Fair?
The Toy Fair. That's what I read. Yeah. I read Toy Fair. Now that you're saying that, I have like a vivid memory of like some article in Toy Fair that was just talking about how shitty the 1990 the remaster re-release of the Kenner Star Wars toys, the Princess Leia, and just how shitty it was. Mm-hmm. It was just like an article about how terrible the Princess Leia toy was, and it was just about how like her face looked mannish, and it's like, it's like that wouldn't like,
yeah, it,
just,
it was never, it
was
happen
a, it was a different time.
Yeah,
it was like that. And I just remembered this missing part of my childhood of like reading these books and like being like weirdly caught up in the insider continuity of comics and toys and trading card games and things like that, just from reading these magazines.
Yeah, it's funny because I have two thoughts on that. One, it's hilarious to me that the comics magazine is called Wizard, because that name has nothing to do with comics. Like, yeah. On the first like couple issues, they dressed Marvel and DC characters in wizard robes with a wizard hat. And then by like issue 3 or 4, they're just like, eh, fuck it. The name of the magazine's Wizard. Moving on. Whereas like Toy Fair, Starlog, Famous Monsters of Filmland, like, you know more or less what the magazine is. A magazine called Wizard, is it a fantasy magazine? Is it a magazine about wizards? Like, what the fuck is this? It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Which is really funny to me because I think it started as like a newsletter that Garib Sheamus had. Like, I think maybe his dad owned a comic store or something. And so he had a newsletter that he would like print out every X amount of time and sell to the, or give to the patrons. And And like he finally decided to do a magazine zine thing and he sold a bunch of them. And then all of a sudden now he has a business selling this magazine. And he kind of like has this meteoric rise over the 90s. And then similar to the comics industry, this crushing defeat where the magazine kind of stops publishing in the early 2000s. And then he and his brother are deeply involved in the convention side of the wizard business. And his brother, at some point, Garib Shamus leaves. And I remember it being under shady circumstances, but I don't remember why. But Stephen Shamus gets fucking arrested because Stephen Shamus is stealing bags of money and memorabilia from celebrity guests at the wizard conventions. Like, he literally would just go into people's hotel rooms.
A cartoon burglar?
Literally. Because, like, I don't know if you've ever read about this, but, like, the business model for these kind of, like, comic book celebrity the actors, they do photo opportunities. And sometimes they're, like, $50 a photo. Sometimes they're, like, $200 a photo. And they only accept payment in cash. So by the end of the day...
All right, it's going to be a $200 fee for your table area and another $50 fee for the burlap sack with a dollar sign painted on it.
Yeah. And, like, at the end of the day, you have, like... You know, Chris Evans' handler taking literally trash bags of money up to their hotel room, you know, or you have Elizabeth Olsen's management crew with suitcases filled with $20 bills. And Stephen Shamus got busted because he would bring stuff to get people to sign and then just conveniently leave with more memorabilia than when he got there. And also would, like I said, go into people's rooms and just like, oh, you've got a... I arranged this meeting in your hotel room to get my commemorative Star Trek The Next Generation plate signed, Patrick Stewart. And I see that you have 7 bags of $20 bills over there. Okay. Hey, everybody, look over there. Look over there. Grab a $20 bill bag and run. And like...
Nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's... He ended up getting arrested and like kicked out of the fucking company because of this.
Yeah.
And then...
Jesus.
He and his brother started a new convention circuit called Ace Conventions. And the Ace shows are just movie celebrity people. And it's the same shit where it's a wizard world...
And they're much more ethical because they tell you up front, it's in the actual rules of the convention, that he's going to rob you.
Yeah. It says every celebrity who comes in here is forced to pay a tithe to Stephen Shamus of 14.7% and or one trash bag filled with $20 bills. Yeah. And like, they're just so slimy. Like, I'm friends with Garib Shamus on Facebook. Because I habitually do this, where I'll just like friend request people that I just think are abhorrent. And Garib Shamus's life is so crazy.
Is that how our friendship started?
Yes, definitely.
Oh.
His life is so nuts. His job, in air quotes right now, is that he's an artist, like a fine artist. You want to guess what he paints? White paint mandalas on white canvas. I'm not even shitting you. Like giant, like 15 foot tall mandalas. Not even fucking around. And he, like, sells them in galleries in France and, you know, all over the world where he just, like, is connected to rich-ass motherfuckers who are just like, oh, Garib, you're a nice guy. I'm gonna buy one of your hokey-ass phoned-in, you totally didn't paint this and you paid somebody else to make this and now you're taking credit for it mandala paintings.
You know what I want to talk about now? The story of the time that, in some context... I said, oh, yeah, the Mandela effect. And then you thought that I was like making some kind of pun. And you're like, oh, yeah, like Nelson Mandela. And I went, yeah. and then you were like, oh, yeah, like, you know, the concept of how Nelson Mandela is different to some people than other people. And I was like, yeah. And then you like laughed. And I was like, that's what it is. It's Mandela effect. And you were like, what? No, it's not. It's
Mandala.
It's a Mandala effect. And I was like, no, it's actually Mandela effect. And then you were just like, what?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it was not my finest moment. Look, for some reason I thought that a Mandela effect and a Mandala effect, one of those was a joke. And the other one was the real thing. Only problem is I got which one was the joke backwards. I thought it was like a mandala effect. Like you know how mandala are rhythmically patterned drawings.
Yeah.
You know, and like they're.
Well, you know, some people, they remember it as being the Mandela effect. And there's a different set of people who can swear that it was mandala effect.
I hate you. I hate you. This has been Deep Cuts. I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
Please sub the show. You can find me online at www.heydavebaker.com.
You can find me watching the Sinbad version of Kazam and at dapricewrites.com.
Bye.
Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.